Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
You are.
This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. They're laying off hospitality and airline workers by the thousands. Window shoppers are afraid to cruise the mall, and catalog shoppers suspect the mail. If Americans don't go to restaurants, it affects food distributors, which affects truckers, which affects farmers. The impacts of September 11th keep rippling through the world's economy. How far does the ripple reach, and how deep will it go? This hour, the price of terror. Joining me in the studio tonight is our guest news analyst, Robert Reich. He's the former U.S. Secretary of Labor and currently professor of economics and social policy at Brandeis University. Good evening, Robert Reich.
Tom, how are you this evening?
Very well, thanks. And joining us from the Brooklyn studios of WNYE is James Sirowicki, financial columnist for New Yorker magazine. Hello, James Sirowicki.
Thanks for having me.
Good to have you with us. Here's the question. How has the war on terror affected your business, listeners, your industry, your life, and economic expectations? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Robert Reich, I want to turn to you first and ask you, if you would, to give us in broad strokes, what have the costs of the September 11th attacks and the dribble of fear and anthrax since then been to the U.S. economy?
Well, besides the obvious human costs, Tom, you know, the loss of loved ones, the suffering and insecurity that a lot of people are feeling right now, there are some very concrete economic costs. Number one, the military costs and the costs of extra security. Some $40 billion estimated over the next few months, if you add in what we've spent so far, take it through the end of the year. Secondly, what might be called the molasses effect, or you used a different metaphor, the kind of dirt in the gears. Just all of the ways in which the economy is slowed down because of the security checks. Trucks have to face security checks when they come into Manhattan. I know that James has written about this. Airport lines, border inspections, evacuations of buildings because of suspicious powder or boxes. All of that slows productivity. That's a cost that is probably going to stay with us, maybe even permanently, regardless of what happens to the military cost, because we are going to want to protect ourselves in the future. And then finally, there is the loss of consumer confidence that is affecting the economy more than it might otherwise be affected by the simple downturn in the economy. People just not wanting to spend quite as much, worried about when the next shoe is going to fall, therefore, because they're already deep in debt and because they are not sure that they're going to have a job tomorrow. They hold back from buying, and that leads to a lot of overcapacity. A lot of businesses just are not selling as much as they otherwise would.
And Robert Reich, what about the business loss of confidence? You hear business executives saying they don't know how to plan in an environment like this. They've been through recessions before, perhaps, if they're old enough, but they've never been through one compounded by this fear of terror and its impact.
Well, I think a lot of businesses, when you say business loss of confidence, it really is that they don't know when consumers or when their customers are going to come back. Mm-hmm. They look at the normal shape of a business curve, the normal, you know, the rise and fall of the business cycle, and they say, usually a recession like the one we are probably in right now is over in about, 6, 8, maybe 10 months. This time, though, we don't know it's going to be the usual shape of the business cycle because there is this unknown factor. When is the war going to be over? What's going to be the effect of the war mm-hmm. on our customers?
Mm-hmm. James Sirowicki, we're big fans of your economic eye at The New Yorker. You bring these issues to life in a compelling way. From your vantage, how do you see the fallout of September 11th and its aftermath in the economy?
Well, I would
concentrate on the second thing that Professor Reich mentioned, which was productivity. One of the real impetuses behind the tremendous economic growth of the 90s was that we just got a lot better at using time, in a sense. We made more stuff in less time. And to me, the most noticeable and immediate impact of September 11th was that things are just going to take longer to do. I'll give you a very concrete example. On my way over to the studio this evening, the subway I was riding was rerouted, which, you know, meant essentially it went away from where I was going. Mm-hmm. And all day yesterday that happened throughout the city, primarily due to anthrax scares. And so, you know, it took me longer to get here. And Professor Reich mentioned also the trucks, which was the piece I wrote this week. It's now taking trucks about half again as long, so 50% longer to get into the city. Now, truckers are paid by the hour generally, and, you know, the people, the companies whose goods are being sold have to pay them, and it takes them, you know, again, half as long to get in. That's going to have a ripple effect. In Manhattan, it's going to mean either that we're paying higher prices or that people will just stop coming to Manhattan. And you can see that throughout the economy. Border crossings are an excellent example. One other thing I'd mention is that I think one of the things that happened in the 90s was that the economy got closer and closer, although it's something we'll never reach, to what you might call a frictionless economy. We tried to reduce the amount of time it took to do things. Companies carried less inventory. Mm-hmm. We moved to what was called a just-in-time production. So, you know, the moment you wanted the parts at on your factory floor, they would be there. Well, all the changes that have come about since September 11th make those kinds of things much harder to do because you just don't know when the trucks are going to be able to get there.
And so, where only, it seems, a few months ago, certainly before the bubble burst on the stock market front, we were looking for a takeoff into a new realm of speed and affluence. Now, between the recession, the bursting of that bubble, and the terror attacks, James Surowiecki, do you still feel a hope of that breaking through to a new kind of economic realm, or are we headed the other way?
Well, I do tend to be more optimistic than I think a lot of people, and you know, we can talk about that. But I think at least in the short term, the problems we're talking about are very real. And certainly in New York City, they are explicitly real. But the ripple effects, I think, can be felt throughout the entire economy precisely because of what you're talking about. And the other thing to remember, of course, is that this is coming on top of a bursting of a bubble that in a lot of ways did lead to overcapacity. You know, we had already overinvested in stuff, and now consumers are pulling back, businesses are pulling back, and that just exacerbates the problem.
Listeners, we're talking about the price that terrorism exacts on the U.S. economy and maybe the global economy. But how does it look from your corner? There are 1,000 stories in the city, in every city. What's your economic story in the shadow of terrorism? Has it affected your job, your industry, your business? Let us know. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let us know your story. Robert Reich, we read a lot in recent days about layoffs and production cutbacks and expansion plans being shelved. How much of that can be attributed to the uncertainty that's been brought into our economic life by terrorism and its aftermath?
Difficult to tell, Tom. A lot of the economy was slowing down before September 11th. We were heading into, or perhaps already in, a recession. Layoffs were increasing. Unemployment was going up. People were getting nervous. They were stopped. You know, they weren't going into the malls. And that was the case even prior to terrorism. I think what's happened is that the attacks and also the anthrax scares and who knows what else all adds to the uncertainty, adds to the worry, makes people even more reluctant, perhaps, to go out and spend. But there is evidence that people are going back to the malls, even notwithstanding all of the uncertainty. Mm-hmm. The layoffs are a different matter. I think that some companies are using this time, I hate to say as an excuse, that suggests that they are somehow being a little bit irresponsible, but they are using this time as a time to get rid of a lot of people that they had already planned to get rid of, to wipe the slate clean. And that, of course, does have a multiplier effect that makes people less secure about their futures, and they're not going to buy if they think that they may be next.
James Surowiecki, you've written in some detail about New York. Share some of that with us. In one of your columns, you wrote, cities thrive because the benefits of agglomeration outweigh the costs for both companies and consumers. You said September 11th has imposed an additional cost of living and doing business in New York, and additional costs, even if they're borne only in the short term, can change a city's economy forever. for good. How has New York changed from the small business end right up to the large corporations headquartered there?
Well, one of the interesting things is that in terms of consumers, that is to say those of us who live in – I live in Brooklyn, but in Manhattan and Brooklyn, there actually has been very little impact. You know, the prices we pay for common goods are still the same. There are no shortages. You know, there hasn't been any panic in that sense. But from a business angle, obviously the businesses that are in the in Wall Street, downtown New York specifically, many of them are struggling desperately. Restaurants, for example, are now offering these pre-feast dinners, which are $30 at literally the finest restaurants in Manhattan. And this week, they just extended that for another week. Pretty much at hotels across the city, you can find fantastic deals. One of the only bright spots is Broadway, which for some reason has held up very well. The real question, though, for me is going forward. There's been a lot of talk about, you know, businesses leaving, Wall Street maybe deciding to move across the river. Some of that, I think, may happen, but I'm a little bit more concerned about the question of transportation and trucking. What I was talking about with the benefits of agglomeration is that cities always have the great advantage that if you can get your stuff here, you know you can sell it to a lot of people. And it doesn't – the transaction costs are very low because there are just a lot of people conglomerated here. But now getting into the city and actually physically getting your goods here is expensive. And until those costs start to come down, I think you're going to see a real effect on the businesses outside the city. So I think the city needs to start to think seriously about quite literally remaking its transportation system to ensure that the flow of commerce continues.
Robert Reich?
And this obviously isn't just New York City. What James Surowiecki is talking about is an effect that may be fairly permanent all over the country. Even when we come out of the recession, even when the economy is back on track, as it were, there are still going to be all of these slowdowns, all of these ways in which we can't be quite as productive as we could be before because we have to worry about security.
Let's turn to the phones for a quick call. We're talking about the U.S. economy and the impact of terrorism, the price of terrorism on the economy that we all work and live in. We're at 1-800-423-8255. How are you experiencing these changes, and how does the future look from where you sit in the shadow of terrorism? Greg is on the line. Welcome, Greg.
Well, thanks very much for taking my call. This is Greg from Arlington. We're not the first country to have experienced this kind of terrorism. The U.K. has had that through the activities there, and Israel has too. And I'd like to understand if there are any lessons we could learn, any corollaries we could understand from the economic impact of terrorism in those countries.
Yeah, great question.
Great
question, Greg. Thanks very much for calling. Let's put that first to Robert Reich. What you've just pointed out yourself, Robert Reich, that this cost of bearing increased security and a more slightly less efficient or maybe significantly less efficient manner of production may be with us for a long time. What does that necessarily slow an economy down? What about other economies that have had to deal with the more present threat of terrorism?
Well, other economies were not nearly as flexible, as adaptable, as buoyant as the American economy has been in the 1990s. In other words, we were the beacon light in the so-called new economy of this extraordinary just-in-time frictionless. I think James Surowiecki used the term frictionless economy. Everything could move almost at the speed of electronic impulses. Well, no other economy came close. They were approaching it, but no other economy came close to our extraordinary dynamism.
So does that make us more vulnerable or more
Well, in a way, we are more vulnerable because when we slow down, obviously, we can't be nearly as dynamic. If we have to worry about packages, powder, if there are evacuations, if large agglomerations of people in one place that need face-to-face encounters in order to do a lot of work that requires imagination and spontaneity, if they can't get together very easily any longer, then perhaps permanently, we're not going to be quite as productive as we otherwise were. Other countries, we're not there yet.
And James Surowiecki, we just got 30 seconds, but your thoughts on Greg's question, what have we seen elsewhere in countries that do know terrorism?
Well, Britain, I think, is a hard example because at the time when the IRA was really doing the bombing, that was not an economy that anyone wanted to emulate. Israel, I think, on the other hand, is an interesting example of an economy that has adjusted. But there, I think the question of size is really important. Israel is just so small that the similarities between that and the demands that an economy the size of the United States has, just in terms of borders and openness, are just radically different. So it's hard to find a real strict parallel, I think, that helps us.
We have to take a quick break, but we're talking about the economy in the aftermath of terror strikes. Consumers, all of us, are you keeping your nerve? Is your boss keeping your nerve? Or are there layoffs going on that you don't think are necessary? How is the price of terrorism hitting you in your life, in your company, in your business, in your industry? Call us at 1-800-423-8255 or join us online at WBUR.org. Click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. This is Special Coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This hour, we're talking about the price of terrorism, its cost to the U.S. economy at the grand scale and in your life. We're talking with James Surowiecki, financial columnist for The New Yorker, and our guest news analyst, Robert Reich, former U.S. Secretary of Labor under President Clinton. One of the sectors of the economy to feel the immediate impact of the terrorist attacks was the travel industry. I'd like to bring Jackie Wolfer into our conversation for a moment. Jackie Wolfer is president of International Tours and Cruises, Fifth Avenue in New York. She's been in the travel business for 25 years. She's run an $18 million a year business. She also runs a company that trains travel agents and says that both are suffering. Welcome, Jackie.
Hi, how are you today?
We're good, and thanks very much for being with us. Jackie Wolfer, how have the September 11th attacks affected your travel business?
It's amazing. On September 5th, I left here for a convention to train 3,000 travel agents and had thriving businesses. I came home to dead phones, with the exception of people that were canceling.
Is it coming back? It's been 6 weeks or so now.
It's coming back slowly but surely. It's, you know, not what it should be. It's not what it was. But people are still afraid to fly. There is an incredible fear of travel today.
Is that the number one thing you heard from consumers when they called to cancel?
Absolutely. It's been fear. And one of the things I've tried to stress to them, it's never been safer to fly. You're safer on an aircraft than you are on a bus or a train. But with all the media and all the hype about the possible terrorism attacks in the future, people are afraid to fly. They're staying close to home.
So, Jackie, you're a seasoned businesswoman. You've been in the business for a long time. What's your new view of the future of your industry, the travel industry?
Well, I've always felt confident no matter what happens, people forget. Travel doesn't stop. They just redirect where they're going. So if there's a war going on somewhere, they just change direction. But it's very scary. There are layoffs galore in the airlines, in the travel agencies, the tour operators. Everybody's suffering, and it's really creeping back a lot slower than everybody thought.
And you have helped train travel agents. It's traditionally been a place with plenty of jobs, but now what's the outlook for people coming into the industry?
Prior to September 11th, we were training between 120 to 150 students every 6 weeks. We were staffing the majority of the travel agencies in the tri-state area, the airlines, the cruise lines, the tour operators, the car rentals. We had over 95% job placement. We had more job openings than we had graduates to fill, and now nobody's looking to get in the industry. They hear of all the layoffs, and companies aren't hiring. They're laying off. They're doing salary cuts. There's freezes on hiring. It's really a frightening experience.
And Jackie, what do you hear in New York beyond your immediate industry? When you talk to your friends who are in other businesses, do you hear echoes of this, or is travel unique?
What we're finding, and I keep in contact with people throughout the country, and I think New York is a lot slower because the impact was felt here the most. If you were lucky enough to be a survivor from the World Trade Center, you were out of a job. Business is down. I looked at the numbers in the hotels. Hotels are at 45% occupancy when this is their prime time for conventions, are usually at 95. Restaurants, there's, I believe, at least 60 closings. I speak to businesses midtown, uptown. Businesses down as much as 60, 70, or 80% in all areas, whether it be retail, whether it be restaurants. It's just really sad, and people are afraid to spend money.
President Bush asked us to go to the mall and go to Disney World. You're in travel. Are people going to Disney World?
people are going to Disney World, but now with the reports coming out that that was a possible target for terrorism, people are concerned. People are staying away from the major tourist attractions right now. They have a fear of going near high-rise buildings.
Jackie Wolfer, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Jackie Wolfer is president of International Tours and Cruises on Fifth Avenue in New York. And Robert Reich, there you have it. There's one woman who's run a very successful business, and she's just run into a buzzsaw that the terrorism has produced.
Tom, I hear this all over the country. It's not only, again, tourism and travel. It's also retail, restaurant. Many of the people who are being laid off, by the way, are low-income people, because in the retail and restaurant and hotel industries, that's where you have a bulk of low-income service workers. These people don't have savings to fall back on. They are not eligible for unemployment insurance, most of them, and they are therefore in trouble.
We have a lot of callers who want to join the conversation. Let's turn to the phones. Ed is on the line. Welcome, Ed.
Hi, good evening. How are you?
We're well, thanks.
Great show. Dr. Reich, it's always a pleasure to hear your voice. I hope you've been well.
I have. Thank you, Ed.
It's been a while. Wanted to ask the question. I'm building a software company, a startup. My business partner and I said, you know, there's no time like the present. We've got a great idea. But I'd like to know from you, Dr. Reich, what it is you're hearing sort of on a macro level from the VCs, from your contacts. I know you still are plugged in D.C. And other places and here in New England. What are you hearing? What are people saying? What's their experience, and are they going to come out of their hole at some point and start giving money again, or is this a permanent retrenchment?
No, I don't think it is a permanent retrenchment, Ed. People are talking about maybe the third quarter of 2002 as the turnaround. Some people are a little bit more optimistic. They're saying the second quarter of 2002. And the real bears are saying the fourth quarter of 2002 in terms of the turnaround. But there is this longer-term lingering question, which is what's going to happen to productivity? Is this economy going to be as flexible and as dynamic as it was before, simply because we've got to take so many precautions? And that is the one that we just don't know.
So it doesn't matter that we have the best schools on earth, the best transportation system, the best technology, the best leadership, the most amount of money. You're thinking that it's this infrastructure thing that's slowing stuff down, and the VCs are unwilling to lend because
they're afraid, they're uncertain. And again, I think that money is going to come back. The investors are going to come back. They have very few other alternatives, ultimately. But it's going to take some time.
Ed, thanks for your call. James Sorwicki, let us put that to you as well. How about the VC community in New York? Robert Reich says it will come back. But on the other hand, we're saying that high-speed, frictionless economy that attracted so many millions, billions of VC dollars may have been scared away here. What do you hear from the venture capital community in New York? That's the high-octane end of the economy.
Well, in New York, the VC community is in very tough shape, but that was really before September 11th. And I think a lot of the skittishness on the part of venture capitalists right now is actually just because they poured so much money into investments in 99 and 2000. The amount of money, I think it's 10 times as much money was raised in venture capital in 2000 as in 1990. And so, you know, that money had to go somewhere, but in a lot of cases it went down the drain. And I actually think that probably has more to do with the skittishness that a lot of VCs here, but especially in Silicon Valley, feel. In terms of the broader question about, you know, the frictionless economy and what happens to it, you know, I tend to be optimistic that America will figure out how to get around this in some ways. But I do think that, you know, that's something that the venture capitalists are going to be thinking about. On the other hand, presumably that will also open up other kinds of economic opportunities, you know, whether it be in the field of security or, you know, figuring out ways to make transportation move more smoothly. So, you know, if your product is fantastic, I have a hard time believing that there's not going to be a market for it eventually.
How about it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about the economy. Are you thinking of going into the security business in the aftermath of September 11th? Is the security business the new way for you, or are you confident that your neck of the economy will come back? We have a lot of callers who want to join us. Chris is on the line. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you. I'm wondering if there's just a little different way of looking at this, in that since technology is one of the strengths of our country and there is a lot of VC money and equity dollars sitting on the sidelines, whether a lot of those dollars can be put to work to produce technology that would both develop the technology to help increase security, whether it be to recognize what's in a package and that sort of thing quicker to save time, but also to produce all sorts of new industries that could spur on the economy. And certainly in the short term, I agree that there's going to be a lot of negative results of what's happened, but I'm wondering whether some of the strengths that we have in our economy and as a country, we can turn this around and make some positives out of this and be stronger for it.
Yeah, it's a great question, Chris. Let's put it to Robert Reich first. What about it? And in a way, what Chris is asking, will we have the wartime boom that we've seen in previous military confrontations?
Well, we're not going to have the same wartime boom because this war doesn't look like it's going to use up as much of our capacity as previous wars have. We're now talking about $40 billion. Maybe it'll go to $80 billion, but that's still less than 1% of our total national product.
As opposed to World War II, let's say?
Oh, when we were talking about multiples of our national product.
Mm-hmm.
But, Chris, you're also suggesting that we have the technological wherewithal to make smarter decisions with regard to how to utilize technology for the purpose of security. I hope there's something else going on here, that, and maybe I'm seeing silver linings where there aren't any, but I hope that a sense of social solidarity, that people saying we're all in this together, gives rise to some more concern about how to spread the wealth and enlarge the circle of prosperity, both in this country and also around the world.
The Republican perspective has been that concentrating the wealth raises the tide in all boats.
Trickle-down economics.
Well, or even now there's talk about capital gains tax cuts, which surely have that as their principle.
Well, I don't think that a capital gains tax cut is really going to stimulate much economic activity because the people who are going to spend a lot of money are people who don't have enough cash right now to spend. Wealthy people presumably are going to spend. They're already spending all that they want to spend. So to give a tax cut in the form of capital gains taxes or other income taxes that go mostly to the wealthy is a sort of inefficient, not only inequitable, but inefficient way of stimulating the economy.
We've got a caller who's more or less on this point. We're at 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about the economy in the aftermath of terrorism. David is on the line. Hello, David.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I actually sent some email to my senators, Kennedy and Kerry, about this, but never got a response. And the thing I was wondering was, especially since we are giving all this money to the airlines to kind of bail them out, is why aren't we taking more of a wartime approach to this and saying this is, you know, an effort that we all have to sort of pitch in on? And maybe instead of laying off people, how about just reducing work hours and maybe everybody works 80% and everybody has 80% or 70% of something, rather than some have all and some have none, especially in industries like the airline industry and the travel industry and stuff like that. Why not treat it like a real wartime effort where we're all pitching in?
Got it.
Is this stupid or?
It doesn't sound stupid, but let's see what our guests make of it. Let's put that to James Surowiecki. Does the new solidarity that Robert Reich spoke of extend to business practices here? Are we ready in a kind of wartime spirit to share the burden of that in a new way? Do you see that in New York or around the country, James Surowiecki?
Well, I think there was some of that in the immediate wake of it. You could see it on Wall Street, certainly. And actually, interestingly, the U.S. News and World Report a couple days ago cut salaries by 10% across the board rather than laying anybody off. But I have to say that any kind of talk about sort of handing down rules or interfering with the way business is deciding to allocate capital makes me at least somewhat nervous, because I think one of the lessons of the 90s was that when we leave things up to business, they're going to allocate capital more effectively than government, generally speaking, with acknowledgement that there are places where government has an important role to play. So I think that is, you know, I would be hesitant to have the state telling people to, you know, only to not lay off people and make everybody else work, you know, only 80% of the time. So, you know, I think certainly during the Vietnam War, there was nothing along those lines. And in terms of the actual role that this war is playing in the economy, it's certainly much smaller than Vietnam was.
Robert Reich, what about the issue of equity in this downturn, partly recession, partly terror-related? Does equity emerge as a new kind of issue because we've got a war on terrorism on?
Well, certainly if the government, business leaders and political leaders are going to say to consumers, be patriotic and go out to the malls and spend, which strikes me as a little bit absurd, given that a lot of people are deep in debt And you can't, you know, to equate patriotism with going on a binge, a spending binge, is not exactly the old concept of patriotism. But it seems to me perfectly appropriate for business and government leaders to say to other businesses and corporations, if you are not facing imminent bankruptcy, try not to lay people off, at least for the next 6 months. We need to build consumer confidence, and it's to everybody's benefit if they have jobs.
Listeners, what about your business, your boss? Are you taking special measures to deal with the downturn? Do you see your company taking measures not to lay people off because it's wartime? We're talking about the price of terrorism on the U.S. economy. We're at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Kevin is on the line. Hello, Kevin.
Hello. Yes, and I'm an admirer of Robert Reich's work. It's an honor to be able to speak with you and your other guests. What I think should be done, and I don't think it's being done, and there are political reasons it's not being done, is an examining a gross inefficiency in our economy that was there before September 10th.
And that was?
That was the massive price distortion and inefficiencies that come from the massive subsidization of oil. The majority, Social Security, Medicare comes from FICA, but almost the majority of our income tax, federal income tax, goes to a war budget. And it seems that a majority of our war budget is to keep prop up repressive regimes in the Middle East. And that's because we need oil. But the idea is, really, that's a hidden mass distortion of the true cost of oil, because we go out and buy a gallon of gas for just over a buck. But the truth is, close to half our income tax is really the price we really pay for oil, and
Kevin,
including this terrorism. So if alternative sources and energy sources, if they had even a fraction of the subsidy that we're giving these oil companies by way of our budget expenditures on war,
we've got it.
Then we'd be able to deal with it.
Robert Reich, Kevin's talking about what he calls a subsidy in the amount of money that we spend, in his words, propping up repressive regimes that let us pump oil out of the Middle East. What about hidden taxes here? Are we looking with a new scrutiny at the oil economy and how it impacts our overall economy?
Well, undoubtedly, Kevin has a point in the sense that we have prefaced and premised a lot of our foreign policy on the basis of energy security. Remember, energy security was the big theme song. It was the theme song with regard to the Iraqi war. It's what we've talked about for years. And although this current war is not ostensibly premised on energy security, we really haven't heard that theme. The predicament we found ourselves in the Middle East, propping up the kind of regimes that we have propped up for many, many years, may have a lot to do with that. So I don't want to go too far down that road, because I don't want to sound, and I certainly don't feel like we need to explain or excuse terrorism in any way. It should be fought. It deserves to be fought on its own terms. But nonetheless, there is and has been an oil economy, an oil-based foreign policy, no question about it.
James Surowiecki, we find you again coming right up to the break. We've just got a few seconds, but do you see this kind of cynicism, skepticism in New York about the sources of the economic price and terrorism here and trying to trace back to Middle Eastern roots?
Well, I think actually people have really not tried to think too deeply along those lines. I think there's actually something to what Kevin said in the sense of, obviously this is an economy that runs entirely on oil. On the other hand, a huge chunk of that U.S. military budget has something to do with the way we conceive of our role in the world. And that, I think, is distinct from oil. And if anything, I think this crisis is only going to enhance this idea that the United States has a kind of global role to play in terms of, questions of democracy, et cetera.
We're talking about the price of terrorism on the U.S. economy, how it's hitting our industries, our businesses, our lives. Let us know how it's hitting yours. We're at 1-800-423-8255. It's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can join us online at WBUR.org. Click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston.
...616060.
This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the price of terrorism on the U.S. economy tonight with James Surowiecki, financial columnist for The New Yorker magazine, and Robert Reich, former U.S. Secretary of Labor and professor now at Brandeis University. We'd like to hear from you. We're at 1-800-423-8255. How has the shadow of terrorism touched your economic life, your industry, your business, your job? Let us know. 1-800-423-TALK. Bill is on the line. Welcome, Bill.
Thank you for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I just wanted to make a comment, really, that I'm in the outdoor business, in the outdoor retail, and our business is good. It's quite strong. We've had significant growth from last year.
So this is coats and camping gear, or?
Yes, we sell all types of outdoor, but ski is very good right now. So mainly outdoor winter, but, you know, ski is doing well, clothing is doing well, hiking is doing well, and we're enjoying it.
How do you assess that, Bill? Why do you think you're doing well?
Well, I think part of it is that we are an escape. Obviously, no one needs to go out and buy a pair of skis right now, but maybe we're a place where they can go and not think about these other things.
I think it's New Yorkers fleeing to the hills.
Part of that, but, you know, we have a good, loyal clientele, but, you know, the subject doesn't come up often. I think we are a place where they can enjoy and think about other things, and, you know, we're seeing some, you know, benefits out of this, and one positive thing on the other side is we're getting better quality applicants at the same time.
You mean job applicants, so it's easier for you to hire.
Absolutely.
Well, I suppose that's inevitable. We're happy to hear the good news, Bill. Thanks for calling. Robert Reich?
Relatively inexpensive escapes or entertainments or vacations, they are very much coming back. People do want to simply escape from some of the stresses. They don't want to spend a great deal of money. And so pitching a tent or going to your local movie, these are things that you're seeing more and more people doing.
James Surowiecki, how about in your realm? Where are you seeing those bright spots?
Well, actually, the movie industry is one that when September 11th happened, people said people aren't going to want to go to the movies. They're not going to want to see X kinds of movies, you know, et cetera. But in fact, the movie industry has held up very, very well. I cannot say the same about the magazine industry, which has gone through some very hard times. There's been a number of magazine closings. Ad spending, for instance, is down. And that, I think, is a response to, you know, as Professor Reich was talking about earlier, that's a problem of trying to anticipate consumer demand. One thing I think is worth thinking about, I think it'll be interesting to see how Christmas is this year, because I would not be surprised if Christmas were very big this year, even given the sort of economic constraints that a lot of people are facing.
Give us your thinking there.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised if actually people at Christmas time have this sense of wanting to kind of lavish attention on and money in the form of gifts on their family members. And you know, so I could imagine a big Christmas at the mall. By that time, it'll have been, what, almost 3 months, I guess. And so I'll
people
be interested to see what happens.
Nesting in and really decking the halls, love the one you're with, all that.
Yeah, exactly.
Robert Reich?
In fact, the whole notion of nesting, cocooning, going back home, hugging your loved ones, giving them presents, this is also part of this post-September 11th economy. I've heard so many people tell me that they are reassessing their priorities, Tom. Maybe they were working too hard. They were buying too much stuff. They weren't paying enough attention to people they love, to a life that they want. And all of this has reminded them of the precariousness of their lives. And so while this may not be good for the economy, if people start becoming more embracing a simpler life, it may be good for their souls,
well,
for the country.
There is the soul, but then James Surowiecki points out that Americans may be able to figure out how to reassess their lives and spend money on the reassessment.
Yes, we would.
If anybody can, we can. James Surowiecki, you were saying earlier, and you've written, I know, that crises can be catalysts, and that there's also ways in which you feel optimism coming out of this. Dig into that for us.
Well, there are a couple things. One is I was thinking about the man who called earlier who was thinking about starting a company. And I think there's actually evidence to suggest that starting a company during a hard time is not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, if you look at the record of the late 90s in particular, when basically everyone and his brother was trying to start a company, Tom.
Hello.
And You know, I think that part of the problem is there was just so much capital out there that it was, you know, easy either to overspend or alternatively to kind of maybe not think hard enough going in about what the demands were. And certainly starting a company during a time like this, assuming it lasts for a little while, will force people to really think hard about what they're trying to do. Mm-hmm. The second thing is, I am somewhat of an optimist. You know, Alan Greenspan has said a lot along these lines. I honestly believe that assuming that, you know, the economy is able to go and continue to work its way out and we don't do hysterical things in Washington in terms of policy, that in the long run, I think the sort of ingenuity and energy of the American people, and I know that sounds somewhat sappy, will play out. And you know, you can already see this. Just take cars. I mean, you know, the 0% financing that's being offered. I mean, it's very tempting when you see the 0% financing not to think, I need to buy a car, even if you don't want one. Right. And, you know, the car sales were fantastic in the last few weeks. So I think that is going to play itself out in useful ways.
Yes, it may well. We can hope for that.
Right.
We're at 1-800-423-8255, and Steve is on the line. Welcome, Steve. Good to have you.
Hello.
Hello, Steve. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Your question or comment?
My question is about residential real estate. We've been told that this is one of the real high spots of the economy. I'm personally interested in it because I'm in the middle of a transaction selling my house. Mm. And what I've heard from realtors is that all of a sudden the market has just gone totally quiet, both for sales and for rentals. So what I'm wondering is about the future of residential real estate, and will the low interest rates be enough to continue to prop it up? And if it does fall, how does that fall play out?
I'm sure that a lot of ears are perking up right now, Steve. Let's put that to our guest, Robert Reich. We've already seen 401s, K retirement plans, take a big hit in many people's accounts. Homes are another source of investment for many people looking toward retirement. What is the strength of the real estate market?
I think over the long term, very good. Home sales and home values have maintained themselves. It has slowed down a lot because the economic activity has slowed down, so people are not selling, they're not buying, they're not moving, they're not changing jobs, they're kind of hunkering down right now. But in terms of keeping the value, homes continue to be a very good way, a very good nest egg for people, and they can only get better. Now, again, this is regionally, this varies by region. There are certain regions that are going to be harder hit by this recession than other regions. Home sales and home values in those hard-hit regions are probably going to take something of a hit.
And, James, you're sitting in a famously high-priced real estate market there. Are New Yorkers still willing to step up and pay those prices to live in the city?
Well, there hasn't been a lot of panic selling, and prices are actually still outrageous here. But New York is interesting because, you know, in the wake of the 87 crash, housing prices fell dramatically, something like, you know, 30% from their peak, I think. And the truth was the bubble had somewhat, if not burst, at least had plateaued for probably close to 6 months before September 11th happened. So far, it seems okay, but I think what Professor Reich said is right. I mean, in the long run, certainly nationally, housing prices will be, you know, over the long run, an excellent investment. And in fact, housing starts in the last month were, you know, did not decline dramatically. New York City, I think, you know, it's going to be different. There's a whole region right now, a whole area of the city that's basically sort of shut off.
Wide open green field, but at some point will be opened up again.
Presumably, yeah, absolutely. Mm.
Robert Reich, final thought. If we get another attack, does that change?
Absolutely, Tom. All bets are off. Let's hope and pray it doesn't happen. James Surowiecki referred before to the resilience of America and the American economy, suggested that might be a little sappy. But I agree with him. I think it's absolutely true. We are, by nature, optimistic. We are upbeat. We are resilient. Should there be something else of the scale, again, let's pray it doesn't happen, of the scale of September 11th, however, that ebullience, that optimism, that resilience might just fade, at least for a time.
James Surowiecki, thank you very much for joining us this evening.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Good to have you. James Surowiecki is financial columnist for The New Yorker, and Robert Reich, former Secretary of Labor, now at Brandeis University. Thanks very much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. Now, painful memories from a different war. Robert Master is a physician and a Vietnam veteran. He says he cannot help but see in the faces of Afghan refugees images from a 30-year-old quagmire.
For so many of my generation who went to Vietnam, that war with its painful lessons has become the defining event of a lifetime. I am one such Vietnam veteran who has never come to peace about the Vietnam War, and our nation's response in the aftermath of the tragedy of September 11th has only served to unearth some very painful memories long buried over three decades of everyday joys and sorrows of family, work, friends, and just plain living. I went to Vietnam in 1969 as a young, untrained doctor just out of internship, drafted because of the urgent need that year for combat infantry battalion medical support, and I was sent to the 101st Airborne Division in Tua Tien Province, where some of the fiercest fighting of the entire war had been occurring. I did not experience the extreme horror and risks of the infantry grunts, but I did experience my share of terror from frequent rocket and mortar attacks, and I bore witness to unspeakable suffering as the war ripped apart the entire fabric of rural Vietnamese society and destroyed so many young Americans who, along with countless Vietnamese, were the victims of a never-ending train of false assumptions. As long as I live, I will carry with me the memories of the forcible relocation of hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese civilians to a world of disease and death in squalid refugee camps. And I will always remember the terrorized, brutalized, killed, maimed, and emotionally crippled young Americans, many barely beyond high school age, just like my three draft-age sons today, who were sacrificed on the altar of arrogance and hubris. Maybe I'm completely incapable of seeing the present in any way other than through the lens of Vietnam, but the blank stares of despair, anguish and anger in ill-clad Afghan refugees holding emaciated infants and children in televised images are the very same faces that I encountered over 30 years ago in Vietnam. And the images of destruction are reminders of the most powerful bombing campaign in history that went on all around me. But beyond this, I see unmistakable parallels between the new war in Afghanistan and the war in Vietnam. Today's perceived problem is terrorism. Back then, it was guerrilla insurrection. But both of these problems are really consequences of a complex set of political, social, and economic injustices. Then as now, bombing is supposed to achieve an objective, but it does not. Civilians are not supposed to be killed, but they are. The indigenous population is supposed to support us, but they do not. Then after all of these failed assumptions, we introduce ground forces, at first on a small scale, but eventually with overwhelming military power to control much of the country, and they live a lie. They are told that they are liberators, but they are viewed as occupiers, and over many years they are picked apart spiritually and physically. If those of us who went to Vietnam have any wisdom to impart at this crucial time, I believe it would be this. Beware of any tendency towards arrogance and self-righteousness. Beware of anyone with a strategy to win hearts and minds. Beware of armchair generals who have never experienced the consequences of decisions to send young men into combat. And lastly, listen carefully to the courageous moral and practical positions of the anti-war movement. I realize that many don't want to hear about the experiences or nightmares of an aging Vietnam veteran. But once, not too many years ago, we were blinded by the power of our technology and the certainty of our cause. We must not allow that to happen again.
Robert Master is a physician who lives in Brookline, Massachusetts. We'd like to hear from you. How has the war in Afghanistan touched you? How has the terror hit your corner of the economy or the corner of your heart? Send your submissions for future radio diaries by email to special@wbur.org. You can listen to or read transcripts of other radio diaries featured on our program. Log on to our website at WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR in Boston.